Good morning. So last time we sort of finished up talking about metrics for measuring network performance. So we talked about sort of measuring throughput, maybe attempting to measure transmission delay, but not really succeeding because, well, there's really lots of packet processing involved in our sort of overall latency numbers, because we typically can't measure when a bit goes in on a link to after. You can only measure sort of when there's processing at either end happening. We looked at the performance of stop and wait, and we saw that it wasn't great, especially, you know, when we didn't have a super low latency link or a super low bandwidth link, which is more and more the case these days. So we talked about sort of sending multiple things at a time, and our strategy for this was a sliding window, that the window would be the number of packets we have in flight. And we had a notion of this for the sender and receiver. So for the sender, it's the maximum number the sender would have sort of unaccounted for. And for the receiver, it was the maximum number the receiver would accept ahead of the first one they were expecting. And we found that sort of the window size sort of let us, you know, if we set it correctly, which we'll talk about in several weeks, actually, when we talk about congestion control, will let us sort of optimally use our connection. We'll talk actually a little bit about setting the window size, but not in realistic scenarios. Like, the big thing we'll be missing that congestion control deals with is that usually when I have a connection, I'm using links that are shared with other things. So we'll talk about what it looks like when you don't share it with other things. Yeah. So questions on things we covered last time or stuff on the quiz? Yeah?
On the quiz for the question regarding where we drop two packets, I don't understand why it's just 5 additional milliseconds, because I thought we had to account for an additional millisecond to retransmit the packet.
So question, why when we drop two packets was it only 5 additional milliseconds?
Yeah.
So under the assumption that sort of our transmission time was negligible, we basically transmit multiple packets effectively at once. Like, probably really they're like separated by a few microseconds, but we were ignoring that. And when these two packets were dropped, we detected that in an appropriate, the question was how long was it for us to detect that? And once we detected that, sort of how far behind were we in the rest of the connection? And I believe the way the question was set up, we were basically one round trip time behind. But in the next round trip time, we resent those packets and kept going.
So we wouldn't also count the time to send the packet back as well? Because it takes 1 millisecond to send a packet.
I believe in that question, first acknowledgement. Okay, so yeah, okay, I need to think about what that is. I will just preliminarily, I can just do this. Just accept the people who gave 5 and 5.1. Assuming my TAs check the question, well, I guess 5 is the majority answer, so yeah. I'll accept 5 and 5.1. That is done as effective now if you refresh. And I will think, I will have due actual partial credit, and hopefully we don't discover I goofed on the question. Sorry, yeah. I was thinking of a different question. And that may have been why I wrote the key wrong. Because I agree that key probably should say something about that, even if 5 is the correct answer. Let me think about the person. Other questions about the quiz? Yeah?
What's the process for getting the answer on question one? I'm just a little confused.
For question one, what's the process for getting the answer? So for question one, we were asking about the benefit of a cut-through switch. And kind of in, versus a store and forward switch. And the problem with a store and forward switch is we need to wait for a whole packet to come in before we do anything with it. And this means that we're going to receive the whole packet, meaning that's going to take the transmission time of the packet to do that. And only then are we going to start transmitting it out. So basically, every hop we have, we add a new transmission time there. The benefit of our store and forward switch, sorry, of our cut-through switch, is that we can start transmitting immediately, so we only pay for a little the transmission time that it takes us to transmit the stuff to know where to put the packet. In this case, that's the first 8 bytes. Once we send those first 8 bytes, that's going to be enough. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so there was some anonymous feedback and other feedback. I'm not sure what number of people from, but on the difficulty of the framing assignment and time taken by TAs in office hours, I've hopefully discussed with my TAs that if there's 5 people in office hours, you need to talk to all of them in a typical 30 minutes. And that's just hard to do. TAs need to get used to that, etc. On the framing assignment difficulty, it is harder than I expected it to be. So as of yesterday evening, about 60% passed all of test.py, so it's not like a total disaster, but it's not great. I was originally planning on basically just auto-grading it, but based on that, I'm going to have us recode. It's going to take a long time to grade, but that's what we'll do. Because I don't think I can give reasonable partial credit for most cases that way, because my original plan was like, if you didn't handle corruption, that was, you had a 60%, and given this, I shouldn't do that. And talking, I taught my TA meeting yesterday, so talking with TAs and me, so probably the change, if I use this assignment in the future, the biggest change I need to make is I need to have clear ways of testing without test.py. Like, technically, this is a thing you could have done. You could write a separate Python main.py that calls your code and test things, but I don't think many people did that. So I probably should supply that, because people having bad testing and testing sort of practices and testing practices should take extra time for them was a big problem. Another thing we noticed is that it seemed like students were spending a lot of time before they compared what happened on their sender and receiver, which we think for that this assignment was the best debugging strategy almost all the time. But students spoke a lot of time to get there, trying lots of other things first often, or just basically trying lots of other things first, it seemed. And that, I think, was a very inefficient use of time for people. And this is I think, usually the best debugging technique. Even if you have something conceptually wrong, this is usually where the fastest way to figure it out. And the other issue is that a bunch of people were confused about the use of byte arrays. So the code uses byte arrays to store arrays of bits, because there's no bit array in Python. But that was confusing and probably should have been explained. But my plan is I'm going to try to just deal with this in grading and not have us keep spinning on this more and more. So questions on the assignment? Okay, so I'll talk about the next assignment. So the next assignment is to do stop and wait, that sort of simple packet structure, do Friday. We supply you a packet structure you have to use. It has an ACNUM, a sequence number, data is end flag and timestamp. The idea is that this is used sort of for on the receiver only, and this is used on the sender only. And you send packets back and forth. We have a simulated network with queuing. We'll talk actually about what the simulation model is when we talk about what's the optimal window size in a bit. And you also have space for a timestamp in the packets, because part of the assignment is to figure out sort of the round trip time dynamically by just measuring timestamps back and forth. We have a simulated network with queuing, as I said. We have a call me on timeout function with a cancellation option. So that's how you're going to set timeouts for resending, and you'll call the cancel when you receive the actual act so you don't keep sending more and more and more, more stuff. Also need to send timeouts, if you time out the second time, you need to keep resending. And your send function on the sender side is going to say whether you can accept more packets yet. So you'll probably, in this first part, you'll just return false. Return true the first time, but you'll return false if you have something you haven't finished sending yet. Or you can queue it up, that's allowed, but you don't have to do that. So a note on the API is there's a trace function in the supply code, and there's a trace option you can enable and disable or change. So that's a built-in way to get debug prints that you can just turn off, including at the command line. You don't have to use that, but it's there. So that's part one of the assignment, part one. And there's a second part, which is listed as due next week, but I'm going to change that. As for why I'm going to change that, I'm gone Friday through all of next week. I am going to hopefully have internet, but I will be in Kazakhstan. And hopefully hotel internet in Kazakhstan will be functional, but I don't anticipate getting much actual stuff done. Professor Campbell, who's taught this course before, will cover my lectures. And related to that, originally the part two of this reliable assignment was doing sliding window. Originally that was due next week. I'm thinking it over, probably should not have that due when I'm gone. So that will be due the work week after. I encourage you to do it early, but I just want you to have time to actually talk to me if there are troubles with it. Now, originally I had no assignment due the week after no submission due the week after because we have an assignment using something called P4, which you have to run in a VM. And I just wanted time to debug if you have trouble running things in a VM. So please, when I come back, make sure you check that VM works for you if you are in a situation where VMs are hard to run on your machine. So we can make that sure that happens and that assignment goes smoothly. Yeah?
What are you doing at Kazakhstan?
The International College at Programming Contest, they require a coach to be there to chaperone, even though I think there's no purpose to that. So I'm the person doing that because I promised McBurney that if he did the nationals, I would do the internationals if it came to that. So there's that upcoming assignment which requires the use of a virtual machine image. So if you have a weird situation, most notably an M1 Mac, probably you should figure out the infrastructure early with that, and just so you can talk and figure out what to do. Like, if necessary, you can probably get loaner laptops from the department. But obviously that would be better not to do it the last minute. Yeah.
So is that like a specific VM image that you're giving us?
Yeah, so there's a VM image I'm giving you. I also have instructions if you want to make your own VM image.
Okay, could we do that if we have an M1 Mac?
So in theory, those instructions will work on an M1 Mac for an ARM VM image, yes.
Okay.
But I do not have an ARM machine. I looked into building an ARM VM image on Linux with emulation, but the instructions involve compiling things. And doing that in an emulator is really slow.
All right.
And I still wouldn't be able to test that it works on a Mac. So I didn't opt to do that. Okay. So other logistical questions. And I will update the schedule page later today to reflect when part two is due. Yeah?
You said there'd be instructions on how to set up our own VM if we wanted to use VirtualBox or something like that.
Question, how to set up your own VM. So we'll supply you with a VirtualBox compatible image. And this image is actually, so the assignment is dealing with something called P4, which we'll talk about when we start talking about switches. And the people who do tutorials before have basically built this image. and they have instructions for building a new one. And you can use those instructions. Okay, so let's talk about sort of optimal performance with sliding window. So I'm going to have a simple model of a network here that I have a sender sending stuff into a queue, which can store 20 packets, 20 frames, and a network that sends things 10 frames a second with a 1 unit time delay. And going back, I have a queue which stores 20 frames and can send 100 acts a second, we just assuming acts are smaller, with a 1 unit time delay. And this is actually, And this is the network model our assignment has. So we simulate these queues. So if you send too much, things will get dropped. That shouldn't be a problem if you set the window size correctly and actually use it. And in this case, we're going to assume no losses other than things getting dropped. Obviously, in a real network, you can have losses from other problems. And so let's do a different situation here. So here I have a queue with capacity 10. What is my maximum latency? From sender to receiver, one-way latency. Maximum sort of one way. This is not the round trip. Check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what's going on. So who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? B? C? D, or first C, second C, D, E, F, G, no clue. Okay, so lots of no clues. So the latency of this part is one time unit. And this is our propagation delay. And the other issue we have and is like, what's our transmission delay? And we kind of abstracted that out in an annoying way here. So we can either like model it as, so presumably by saying this is one time unit delay, yeah, this is actually probably propagation delay plus transmission delay. Because I gave you the total delay. So that's the total transmission and propagation delay is one time unit. But then we have this Q. What does this Q do to our maximum possible latency? Well, the worst case is that this Q has 9 things in it when we start, and we're just starting to transmit the first thing. So we can wait behind, and we're transmitting. So we have 9 things here, and 1 thing just starting to be transmitted. So our worst case is we have to wait for 10 things ahead of us to finish being transmitted. The thing that's being sent just right on the wire right now, and then the next 9 things that are in the queue behind us, or in front of us, sorry, in front of us in the queue. So I believe we sort of get E for that case, because each of them is going to take 0.1 units to transmit. This is equal to 0.1 time units a frame. So we can wait and have to wait for 10 of them. That's going to take 1 time unit. So we get a total latency of 2 time units. Questions on how I came up with that? Okay. And in our scenario here, we have a queue with capacity 20. So that would give us a latency of 3 time units instead of 2. And I showed you this graph earlier, last time, of the sort of empirical throughput. And this is in this scenario here. And I've sort of had these 2 dotted lines You might say, like, why is that region our maximum throughput? What's going on there? And to think about that, let's think about what goes on kind of when there's not much going on. We're going to send a piece of data. It's going to take one time unit to get from the sender to receiver. And then with hopefully negligible time, we're going to send an ACK. And that's going to take one time unit to get from receiver to sender. And if everything's quiet, the queue is going to be empty, so we don't have to wait for anything. So that's kind of our base round trip time is two time units in this case. If we have queuing, it's going to be a little higher, but it starts at two time units when things are quiet. And we can send 10 data frames per time unit in both directions, both ACKs and the originals, the data. So we can send 20 before that round trip time happens. And this is called the bandwidth delay product. So we have 10 per time unit times 2 time units round trip time. We get 20. And this, not coincidentally, was our sort of where the top of that sort of graph was, that our best throughput, you know, was achieved there initially. And then we have some other cases where we also achieve the maximum throughput and then it collapses. And if we do the same calculation of sort of throughput and delay, we get that when we get over here, we're getting to this point here. This is our bandwidth delay product with, did I screw up on this question? No, okay. So we got to our bandwidth delay product with the maximum delay. Sort of that's where our variation comes in. So kind of, but our sort of, our normal maximum case up here, that is from filling sort of pipe. We're just sending, using the length all the time exactly. That's why that happens. Okay, so questions about how I got that maximum? And we have this collapse. When we increase it too much, when we increase it a little bit over that, we just start filling up the queue, and that's okay. When we increase it too much over that, the queue gets totally full, and we lose. Because things start getting dropped, and we need to spend a bunch of time recovering from that, and that's going to be very inefficient. So, this
is there. Why is that point larger than the capacity of the queue by more than one? Like, it feels like as soon as you go past the capacity of the queue, then it's two more than the queue capacity.
So here, so this region, in this region we have zero queue usage.
Yeah. Oh, okay, I see. Okay.
That
makes sense. Yeah.
Makes sense, yeah. So it's only when we start going slightly over that do we start getting queue usage. And kind of some of the added delay counteracts our increased amount we're sending, but it only works so much. Does that answer your question? Okay, and so the bandwidth delay product is kind of our rule of thumb for setting the throughput, sorry, for setting the window size, and yeah, it gets a little complicated because as we send more stuff, eventually things start queuing, but that also means we have like a little bit of slack in. But usually, if you were setting it by hand, you'd actually want to target probably something over here because low latency is good. And what's happening over here is things are taking longer and you're not sending any more data. That's not actually good. Okay, so questions about our full throughput case? Okay, so because we can kind of control our throughput, we can use sliding windows to solve kind of two problems that one of which we'll talk about in detail later. So one is of them that we've kind of seen is flow control, which is that we want to keep the sender from getting too far ahead of the receiver. Our windows also solve this problem because we can tell the sender what to set their window size to, and they can use that to make sure the receiver doesn't like have a 100 gigabytes of data that it hasn't processed yet. The other problem that we'll talk about later is congestion control, is that we want to keep the network from being overloaded, but we still want to try to use all the bandwidth. And by setting our window size properly, that's something we'll be able to do, and that how to do that when multiple people are using the network is obviously way more complicated than computing the bandwidth delay product. Okay. So that's on kind of setting the window size. So one other issue with this reliable transmission is sequence number wraparound. So far we've kind of been setting sequence numbers, and we saw that with the stop and wait protocol, we could use 0 and 1, then 0, then 1, then 0, then 1. And if there was no delayed packets, that was enough to keep us from getting confused. If there's delayed packets, that wasn't good enough. But if there's no delayed packets, that was good enough to keep us getting confused. We don't have an equivalent of that for our sliding window case. Let's come up with that. And here's kind of the worst case for our sort of sender and receiver being desynchronized. Worst case is that our sender has sent all these frames but not gotten ACKs for any of them. So it's waiting for acknowledgments for, in this case with a window size of 4 frames. And our receiver has received this packet and not, and is waiting for 4 more things. And we need to have unique numbers for all of these things. And one way we can do that is we can just say, I need 8 numbers, I'm gonna use 0 through 7, and I'm just gonna run them like so. I don't actually need to have them be strictly increasing as long as I do the bookkeeping properly to work out which is which. Okay, so questions? Yeah?
If you do the ordering that way, does that still require no out-of-order packets in the network?
So the question is, does it still require no out-of-order packets? So this, if things are out of order, we're gonna need a stronger constraint. But even if things are out of order, we still need to deal with wraparound because we, if we're sending, data fast over days, we don't want to have like a 64 or maybe even larger bit sequence number. So we're going to want to be able to deal with avoid that somehow by allowing it to wrap around. But yes, as for the issue with reordering, we can absolutely have reordering. So if we have delays in the network, which wouldn't be possible on a normal direct link, but are possible in the real internet, then this is not good enough. We need some other way of coming up with, making our sequence numbers not confuse us. And the scenario which causes the confusion is we can have some old, very old packet that's something that we know has already been sent, that everyone knows has already been sent, we could receive an extra copy of it spuriously if the network reorders things. And kind of one example of how this could happen is if we have two ways to reach our remote machine. You might say, why would this happen? Let's say this is a Wi-Fi network and the other is a wired network. We could change which one we're using, and then, oops, we have this old packet from when we switched over. Questions on this delay scenario? So you might wonder, what do we actually do in practice? And we're gonna talk a bunch about that, what TCP actually does. And TCP's solution to this problem is they want to assume a maximum segment lifetime, so the maximum time they think the network will take to send a packet, and they just assert that that should be not more than 120 seconds. So they, instead of choosing their sequence number size to be twice the window size, they're going to choose their sequence number size to be long, big enough that in 120 seconds, they're never going to have a sequence number reused. But over 120 seconds, fine to reuse it. And originally, this was easy. TCP started with a 32-bit sequence number, and you know, on the 9600 baud connection between sites at the time, that was no issue. But these days, we have very fast links, and this means wraparound can happen in seconds, especially since the sequence number is a byte number, not a packet number. So you might say, what do they do about that? And their solution is that they added on a timestamp field, kind of as an afterthought. You might say, that's weird. Don't we want to know round trip times? Wouldn't we just say that was important? It is. And they didn't think of it in 1981. They didn't think of it till later. But they added on a timestamp field, and they basically use that to extend the sequence number to detect sort of these delayed packets that can happen, even when we have, you know, very fast connections. Okay, so questions here. So let's look at sort of what TCP actually does. So I kind of given you the high level of sliding window transmission, and TCP is the one we almost always use, and it uses bit similar mechanisms, but there's some key differences. So one big difference is TCP is bidirectional. So I've kind of talked about a sender and receiver, and we actually have both sides are senders and receivers to each other. And to kind of be efficient, TCP allows you to combine the roles of both in a packet. So every packet can have a sequence number for data being sent and an acknowledgement in it. So you can acknowledge what on top of data you're sending back. You can acknowledge the data you received. Another big difference is that sequence numbers are byte numbers. They aren't packet numbers. And so the sequence numbers are the index of the first byte sent, and the acknowledgement numbers are sort of one plus the index of the last byte acknowledged. So the sequence number of the next packet. Other difference is that TCP has dynamic or variable window sizes. We'll talk about how that works later when we talk about congestion control, which is the primary way that happens. Also, the official name for packets in TCP is segments. If you read, if you read TCP standards, they'll call them segments, not packets. So questions on these sort of basic differences? Yeah?
Yeah, so the acknowledgement numbers, even though during the examples in lecture so far, it's been like the acknowledgement number is the one from the last packet that we received, but in this one, in TCP, it would be like message to acknowledgement
Yes, question. In TCP, the acknowledgement numbers are ahead of the packet numbers, of the sequence numbers, yes. Yeah, unlike the examples I showed, I figured it would be more confusing to do that in my explaining sliding window, but that is how TCP works. Okay, so let's talk about what a TCP segment looks like. So we have our layers, so TCP is used on top of IP, the network layer, which we'll talk about later when we talk about routing. So we have the lower layer header, which we're not going to show other than to say it's here. We have a source and destination port. These identify the particular program on the source and destination machine. As for which machine, that's all in these lower layer headers. We have a sequence number, which is the byte number for the first data byte in the packet. And I guess this should be one plus the byte number of the largest byte acknowledged. Okay. And there's some flags here, these single bit fields, that, interesting. Control how acknowledgments work. Will control a bunch of things, and one of them is the acknowledgement field valid? So when we're starting a connection, we don't have anything to acknowledge. The solution they have for that is that you just leave the acknowledgement field unset. So acknowledgement bit, sorry, to zero, and you put anything in the acknowledgement field, and it doesn't matter. But this acknowledgement bit here, which, why am I here? Interesting. My slide viewing is acting up. And I don't know why. That is okay, we will solve this problem by going back. Okay, to yeah, okay. So we have acknowledgement number, yes, and our acknowledgement flag here, yeah, indicates whether that's valid. We have a window size, which indicates the initial indicates the receive window size. So this isn't the send window size, this is the receive window size. I mentioned the idea of flow control, that we want to make sure that if you're sending to me, that you don't like send me 10 gigabytes of data I can't handle. And that's done by advertising the receive window size to the other end, the size you're willing to accept, so they don't send more than you're willing to accept. They will actually set their send window size kind of based on this and how fast they think the network can handle. There's this urgent data mechanism in TCP, which we won't discuss because no one uses it. It involves this urgent pointer and this urgent flag here. There's a push flag here, which indicates the sender does not have more data to send right away, just as a hint to help the OS figure out how to give the data back in sockets. And there are these flags that are used in connection management. We'll talk about sockets in probably like a month. And when we do, we'll talk about actually how connection establishment works. I'm going to skip over that for now and just assume our connections are already established. But there's these flags that are used for connection setup. There are some things that are used in congestion control. We may talk about some of these when we talk about congestion control. And you might notice we have this variable field at the bottom, options. So TCP had sort of the original things it had, and then people wanted to add things on, and they thought about this when they created it. So they had these option fields. And to support that, we have to know where the end of the options are. That's what this data offset field is for. It'll tell us where the options end and where the data starts. Some questions? Yeah.
So in the reliability homework, there's an acknowledgement field in the packet, but I can't remember if there's also an acknowledgement flag in that example.
Question, in the reliability homework, there's an acknowledgement field, but no acknowledgement flag. The acknowledgement field in the reliability homework, you can put none there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Or you can make up a sentinel value, but putting none is probably easiest. Or it happens that you should never actually have a reason to send an acknowledgement, a packet from the receiver to the sender that doesn't acknowledge something. In TCP, that comes up because we are bidirectional. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk a bit about some TCP options that come up. So some of these are, because if you look at any modern TCP connection, there will be options. in most of the TCP connect packets. Even though it's not strictly necessary, it's very useful for performance. So one of those options is the window size scale factor. So I say we advertise our window size, our receive window size, so the sender doesn't get too far ahead of us. And you might notice that my window size here is a 16-bit number. And that means that I can send at most 64K at a time is what I'm telling the sender, that I will accept 64K before I accept the next 64K. Only 64K ahead of what you last sent. And that used to be perfectly fine, but it's not acceptable today. So I say, what do we do about that? So there's this TCP option to set a scale factor on that. So that's not in bytes, but it's in like 128 bytes or something bigger than that. And that's kind of necessary if you want to have a fast connection, because otherwise we're sending 64K per round trip max. And that would be, that we're limiting the sender window size to 64K, and that's going to be way too slow. There's an option to add timestamps. We mentioned this is used to extend the sequence number. It's also used to set the timeout that TCP uses. And the idea is that we can send a timestamp when we send our data packet, and that's echoed back, so sent back with the ACK in this, in both cases in this option. And there's also selective acknowledgments. So the acknowledgments we've shown, like we're just acknowledging like one, two, the last thing we received all of, we can say, oh, but I also received some other stuff that's ahead of that, but not everything. We can like kind of give information about the holes. And TCP options have this format where they have a kind field, a length, and the data. So for example, our window scale option has a kind of 3, a length of 3, 1, 2, 3 bytes, and a shift amount, so they just bit shift the window size to make it bigger. The length field's important because it allows us to skip unrecognized options. That's why they're options, so if you don't implement an option, you just know how to skip over it by reading the length field. And these kind codes have unique codes that are assigned by a central organization, the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority. Okay, so questions on... So let's look at... and you can see also, I guess I should point out in timestamps that we have the timestamp for the packet we're sending and the timestamp, being echoed back to us. So we'll take this echo timestamp, subtract it from the current time to figure out the round trip time. And when we send an ACK, we'll copy the sender timestamp into the echo timestamp field. Questions on? Okay. So let's look at kind of an example of a TCP connection in Wireshark. And I've sort of set up Wireshark here to have a sequence number field and an ACK number field. And we initially have some connection set up where if you look at this, the sequence number, I do have a zoom in of that, the sequence number and the ACK number changes, but actually no data is really sent. They just use zero and they used to use the first sequence numbers to show that the connection setup's happening. And we acknowledge that this connection setup. And I'm gonna represent the connection going in the backwards directions with this olive color, so that's why there's two different colors here. And we can kind of see acknowledgments here. So here I have a data packet with bytes 1 through 60. Remember, the sequence number is the first byte. The packet length happens to be 60. We can infer that because there's no gaps, and the next packet starts at 61. And the acknowledgement later on has acknowledgement number 61, so that's when that's acknowledged. We can look at this and say that took 118 milliseconds. by comparing the two times. This should be this number, but the value doesn't change when you round to the nearest millisecond. And in this example, we actually have a case where the bytes being sent in the other direction kind of jump backwards, jump without any data being sent. So we have this first packet. This previous acknowledgement here has sequence number 1 and a length of 0. So it's an acknowledgement with no data, even though we could have sent data. And then we have something with sequence number 29, which means the data starts at byte 29, which means there's bytes 1 through 28 are missing. And Wireshark actually does the analysis with this whole connection, and it figured out, oh, wait a moment, we're missing something. And it knows we're missing something because it said, okay, sequence number 1, length 0, then sequence number 29, something where are bytes 1 through 28? I don't see them. So it's missing, it has to be resent later. And we can actually see later, there's a transmission of that, a retransmission. Wireshark does the analysis to figure out, oh, this must be a retransmission because it's out of order, of sequence number 1 with an appropriate length. Okay, so there's kind of the basics of looking at our sequence and ACK numbers in a TCP connection. So let's look at a particular TCP packet. So this is the first data packet that's in that trace I showed you earlier. And I'll sort of emphasize a few interesting things that are going on. So one thing you might have noticed if you look carefully at our TCP header is that there's some stuff that wasn't there. And one of the things that wasn't there was the actual length of the data. So that's not actually part of the TCP header. It's computed using the lower layers. The lower layer has to know the length, so TCP doesn't bother storing it itself. And Wireshark has computed it, but it computed it by knowing how the lower layer works. The sequence numbers that I've shown you on the previous slide, sequence number 1, 16, you know, but starting with 1, that's not actually how TCP works. TCP starts at a random sequence number. Wireshark converts it to a zero-based index. The reason TCP starts at a random sequence number has to do with security. If you can send only one side of a TCP connection, you can kind of pretend to be someone else on many networks. And if you can guess the sequence numbers, you can do that. If you can't figure out what you need to acknowledge to make that happen, then you can't do that. And so for that reason, modern TCP implementations almost always randomize the sequence numbers they use. And TCP allows you to start wherever you want. But even though it would probably be simplest to start at 0, they don't for security. Is that like really solving the problem is a more complicated question, but that's how it works. So we have our sequence number. Wireshark happens to compute the next sequence number by saying, oh, this is sequence number 1, 60 bytes, therefore, you know, the next number is going to be 61. And we have our acknowledgement numbers. In this case, the acknowledgement number is about the start of the connection stuff, and again, that's also randomized because it's based on the sequence number the other end sent. And you can see they're different random values. We have these flags. In this case, we have the push flag set saying there's no more data right away. You know, I don't expect data right now. And the ACK flag saying the acknowledgement field is valid. That's basically always going to be set once the connection gets started. And we have our window size. In this case, we use the window scaling factor. So this is us telling the other end how much I'm willing to receive from you. Like, it's not saying how much I'm sending, it's just saying how much I'm willing to receive back. And in this case, we're sending a window size of 2,200 bytes, 100 bytes, which is sent as 43 because we have this window scaling option, which doesn't actually appear in this packet. It only appears in the connection setup. So we have to have remembered the connection setup had that option and then figure it out from there. And we also have a bunch of TCP options here. And in this case, we have two no operation options and timestamps. You might say, why are there no operation options? What are we doing with that? And the answer here is that our header size, our data offset field, is in units of 4 bytes, so we needed padding. And the way we padded it is by adding these options that do nothing. Okay. So questions on looking at this data packet? Yeah?
Is the calculated window size also in bytes, or is it in frames?
Question is the calculated window size in bytes? Yes. So all the sizes for windows are in bytes, in sequence numbers and ACK numbers, all in bytes in TCP. And there's a good reason for that, which is that just because we send like 60 bytes in a packet the first time doesn't mean if we resend that, we need to send only 60 bytes. We could like say, oh, I have more data now, let's send 1,000 bytes. And that 1,000 bytes is going to be the 60 bytes I already sent you being resent plus another 900-ish bytes. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so Wireshark also lets you get out the sequence number graphs. So on the side here, I have this zoom in of fear, but on the side here we have a sequence number, and this is only in one direction. So that connection could have that data in two directions. This is only one of those directions. And we have here, this is sort of the sort of last acknowledged sequence number. These little things here are sent packets. And this is from the sender side of things. So there's this gap between when we send something and when it gets acknowledged. That's our round trip time. We also have these little notches here, and these are duplicate acts. Because what happened is that, and when we got one of these duplicate acts, we realized we needed to resend something. So that's a resent packet there. And we have a bunch of duplicate acts until that is actually received. These red lines here, these represent the selective acknowledgement information. So in this case, we were missing this and this. Was missing. And this is from the sender side, so once we figured out that was missing, we resent it right away. And we also have some more examples of that. So here we know we resent it, but we still get, it takes a while for it to get there, so we still get a bunch of duplicate acknowledgments about it with this selective ACK info saying, I have everything after that, but just not that. So questions about looking at this way of looking at the sequence number trace and ACK number trace. And so this is from the sender's perspective. Like, the timings are going to be different from the receiver's perspective. So here's the same data from the receiver's perspective. And we can see here that when we receive something, when there's a data packet, we acknowledge it right away. From our perspective, you know, it gets acknowledged right away. From the sender's perspective, it takes a while for it to get acknowledged. That's just because I'm observing it from the other side of the link. So questions about... showing here. Yeah?
Is there any way to measure round-trip time here?
Is there a way to measure round-trip time here? Absolutely. So, empirically, like, this is basically the round-trip time.
I meant, like, on the receiver side.
On the receiver side?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can really measure it if you don't send data.
Okay.
Though usually you will.
Okay.
I'm not 100% sure. There might be ways of, I'm not 100% sure how the timestamp option works in all the corner cases. I'd have to look it up. Okay, other questions? Okay, so that's where I'm finishing up talking about sort of our sliding window idea. And we're gonna, so questions about any sliding window stuff, TCP stuff, before we start talking about switches. Okay, so let's go back to something we previewed at the beginning of the semester, and that was this idea of multi-access media. So we can have, kind of, we mentioned we can have this one shared wire, or often like a shared radio space that's sort of connected electrically to each other, or we can have a switch network where we have these switches and each link is kind of dedicated to connecting two nodes directly rather than multiple nodes sharing that link. And I showed you this picture of a hub, which I said electrically connected things. And here, let's have a comparison between a switch and a hub. You can't tell the difference. You can, but you have to read. And if we just labeled it differently on the outside, you would not be able to tell the difference. So they look the same from the outside, but what switches do is very different than what hubs do. So the hub is like this electrically connected idea, and the switch sort of actually has sort of logic in it to decide what to output. And kind of historically, we started most networking technology with more of the hub idea. The hub was much more popular, especially in the early days of Ethernet. It used to be that Ethernet usually was hubs, not switches. And we will talk about multi-access stuff later on, because even though for Ethernet we almost never use it, it's still how Wi-Fi works. It's how cellular works, right? We have a shared radio media. And it's also how a bunch of wired networks work in the broadband space. So cable modems, most fiber to the home, are actually the multi-access idea. They have something more like hubs going on. But we'll talk about that near the end of the semester. For most of our semester, we're going to kind of assume a switched wire network, and we'll add the stuff that's different in this sort of wireless space or this broadband space on later. And something that also comes up here is I talked about switches. I also talked about routers. And a good question is, what's the difference? And the difference is that switches, forward frames for a network, routers, forward packets between networks. But that's not actually much of a difference. The functionality is actually really the same. So when we talk about how switches work, most of what we're talking about is also going to be how routers work. And the same is true when we talk about things that are usually specific to routers. Those are all the things that switches could also do. So we're actually kind of learning about both at the same time, because the overall mechanisms are basically the same. We're going to start with switches because what they're doing is simpler, because we typically do simpler things in a local network than we do across many networks like the internet. But all the same ideas are going to be also apply when we talk about routing. It's just a matter of scale, basically. And we're going to talk about Ethernet as kind of our first example, and also because the upcoming P4 assignment is going to use Ethernet. And we're going to talk about the frame format for Ethernet. So Ethernet is the link layer. So we'd have, if we were using TCP, we'd have this data would be IP plus TCP data. And Ethernet's format is Ethernet has a preamble and start marker. So that's kind of like framing. It doesn't actually work the same way as framing because of Ethernet's history as a multi-access protocol. So it's actually, this stuff is designed for multiple people using the same wire, so it can't work the same way it did in the framing assignment. We'll talk about that maybe much later in the semester. But we have a start marker, And we have something that's sort of like an end marker called an interpacket gap, where basically we actually cut power to the wire, effectively. And we have this type field that identifies what the next layer is. So usually this is going to be the IP type. And something that may confuse you if you read documentation about Ethernet is that this type field is also a length field. You might say, why did they do that? I don't know, but that's the historical thing. In modern usage, it's almost always just a type field, and we'll have the length in some other way because we have this sort of, the physical layer of Ethernet gives us the length without us having an explicit field for it, because it can recognize sort of when the packet actually ends. We have a destination and a source, and this is just on the local network because this is a local network protocol. So we have a destination MAC address, which is that machine address. We'll talk about what MAC addresses look like next. And this destination address is present in the packets, partly because of our history of multiple access, but this gives switches a great backup option. That if a switch doesn't know what to do with a frame, it can just send it to everybody, and everybody's going to check this destination field, and if they don't care about it, they just don't use it. So switches always have the option of kind of acting like a hub and just connecting everyone to everyone. Obviously, we prefer not to do that, but this works, and we'll use this fallback option, occasionally. And the frame has a source address. This is basically just a return address for sending replies. It turns out switches will also have some other uses for this we'll talk about later. So questions on our Ethernet frame format? And also, sometimes there's some extra stuff I'm not showing here that's part of the Ethernet layer. We're not going to talk about it, probably, but you might see that if you look up documentation. You might say, wait a moment, you missed something. Yes, I did. So we have these MAC addresses, and these MAC addresses are used by lots of protocols, not just Ethernet. And they're a 48-bit number written in hex, usually with this formatting. You could obviously, it's just a 48-bit number. You could write it in lots of ways, but usually we'll use this formatting where you write it in hex with colon separating it. And these numbers are assigned to networking hardware manufacturers in blocks by IEEE. And for example, Intel has everything starting with 0002B3 and 0003B47 and a whole bunch of others. And they're hard-coded in networking hardware. So when Intel gives you a network interface chip, they're going to put one of their numbers in it, sort of hard-coded in that chip. Questions about format and assignment?
Is it possible to spoof MAC addresses? Like if you write some software that can you send network packets that look like they're from someone else?
Can you spoof MAC addresses? Yes. So most networking hardware will let you choose what MAC address to send with, but they have the built-in one that you should use unless you have a good reason not to. So there are also some special MAC addresses. So all zeros and all is a special MAC address for some placeholders, I guess I should say. It's kind of reserved. The all ones MAC address, actually any MAC address starting with 11 FF, is a special MAC address meaning broadcast, meaning that this is for everyone on the network, no matter who they are. And also, there are some special MAC addresses for multiple receivers. So for example, in IPv6 is reserved this MAC address, 33330000002, to represent all routers on this network. And the idea is all routers will look for that MAC address, anyone else will ignore it. Yeah.
With the all ones broadcasting, is there a way to limit, like, based on certain groups or administrations saying, like, you should only send a certain group? Like,
question. If I want, can I send the broadcast to only a certain group?
Yeah.
So there are things that are going to rely on this really getting to everyone on the local network. If you're a sysadmin who's concerned about that, typically you'll set up your network to effectively have multiple local networks. Would be the easiest way of dealing with that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So, like, basically, doing the broadcast just means what any machines that are available.
Yeah. Doing the broadcast, any machines that are available, any machines that are on what we consider our local network. And you can make your switches, maybe define the local network differently than the intuitive way would be how you, if you're worrying about how far that was distributed as a system administrator, that's probably how you deal with that issue. Is that, like, you divide what otherwise would be one big network into smaller networks, partly to make it so the broadcasts don't go as far. Which, you know, is usually not a security concern, but a performance concern. Yeah?
What is the difference between a MAC address address?
What's the difference between MAC address and IP address? So this Ethernet protocol doesn't care if you're actually using IP.
Okay.
Right. So I said we use that typically we put IP and, you know, this type field is typically going to say IP. It works if that type field is not IP. The other thing is that we'll learn that IP addresses are going to be assigned in a very different way because they're used for routing and our MAC addresses aren't. But for MAC addresses, it's really important they're unique. And the way they're assigned really makes that happen. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
So some note about MAC addresses. So I mentioned that a whole bunch of other protocols use MAC addresses. IEEE now calls these EUI 48, 48-bit extended unique identifiers. And as you might guess from the 48 there, they've created a 64-bit version because it turns out that sometimes 48 bits isn't enough. I'm not sure what the status is on switching, but there are some protocols out there that do use the 64-bit version of the identifier. So an example is IEEE 802.15.4, which is, you might hear called Zigbee. It's used for like smart home stuff sometimes. Like uses the 64-bit version, and presumably the implication there is we might run out of space for smart home stuff. Let's use a bigger number. Okay, some questions? MAC addresses. Okay, so we talked about sort of our Ethernet format, and Ethernet is an example of kind of the datagram model for how a network works. And what I mean by that is we can send what we call a datagram, and we can send something to, at any time to someone on the network. We don't have to wait for permission. We don't have to do any setup. We can just, whenever we want, send this Ethernet frame, and it just gets there. There's no reservation. There's no connection. And this is not the only model that networks are built with. It's the one we're going to talk about because it dominates the internet. But there's kind of another big model I want you to know exists, because some networks do in fact use it, and especially like if we think of the telephone network. And that's this model of a virtual circuit, that instead of just sending data whenever we want, we set up a circuit to a machine, and to do that, we actually kind of send something that tells the switches or routers on the way, hey, I want to communicate with this machine, reserve resources for me to do that. And this approach has an advantage that's really good for, like, if we think of a telephone network, that you can guarantee the bandwidth because you reserved it. And if we're thinking of making phone calls work, especially back in the 80s when we probably couldn't oversubscribe our phone network, make our phone network have way more capacity than it needs, this would be, you know, a good idea. And, you know, this is something that some networks actually used. But the model we'll use for the most part is datagrams. I want you to know this other model exists, and for some applications is a really good idea. But it doesn't work on the internet because we can't get everyone on our path to cooperate with us. Okay. And so our next topic is going to be talking about how switches work. And I'm going to talk about a bit of history for that. So switches and routers historically have been kind of fixed function specialized hardware. You buy a switch or a router, it does this one thing, and it's not very configurable. It has some limited configuration options. Maybe a more advanced switch will have more configuration options. But when it, even when it has configuration options, often it's not very automated. Like, you know, until very recently, often the way you configure a possibly a very expensive switch, like, you know, tens of thousands, very expensive router, I should say, like tens of thousands of dollars, would be by SSHing into it and typing commands, even if you had like 10 of them. And it would be different for each vendor, the commands you run. Got one from Cisco, got one from Juniper, completely different commands. Good luck. And also, there was very little visibility into the internal design. And this situation is kind of like not so convenient compared to like the software situation, where if you're a big player dealing with software, like you can look into what the OS does, you can customize that, you can automate that. And this used to be very hard in the networking space. And it still is kind of hard, but it's getting better. And part of why it got better is because academics really complained. So let's say I was an academic trying to design an extension to Ethernet. I want to add something onto Ethernet and show that it's a good idea. My options, if I want to show that it's a good idea, are I can implement it in the hardware I can make, which is going to be slower, like programmable gate arrays, which are much slower than the fixed function hardware. I can try to convince a switch hardware company to implement it for me and test it. Or I can try to contort my extension to fit functionality in the hardware that maybe isn't intended for this. So for example, maybe I kind of, oh, VPN support lets me change how frames are moved around. So kind of as a reaction to this, there's a movement towards programmable networks and commonly called the software-defined networking, where the idea is that the rules about how the network work wouldn't be built into the hardware you buy with kind of limited configuration knobs, but you'd be able to write programs that set those rules and how it works. And a big change to how kind of switches and routers are sort of present their interface that happened as a result of this is that we have kind of this more explicit division of what we call a control plane and a data plane. And this is probably what switches were doing beforehand, but it's just no manufacturer told you about it. Cisco just said, here are the commands you can run. They didn't tell you like what happened internally. They didn't want you to know. But we'll have a control plane, which is going to decide what to do, how to handle things, and the data plane that actually implements that decision. And kind of the key idea of software-defined networking is that, you know, the control plane is the part that most people want to like change. And the data plane is the part where we need that special fixed functionality. So the first thing the software-defined networking people focused on is sort of separating these two things so you could replace the control plane with another control plane. And if you're a big company like Google, that's really attractive because you don't like SSHing into switches and running random configuration commands and figuring out to make sure that that's actually configuring your giant network the way you expect it to. And so the idea is that by sort of standardizing the separation of these, you could have vendor-neutral implementations of a control plane, or for a company like Google, probably their own control plane, but they use other people's switches with it. They don't have to build their own to work with that. And, you know, probably the most prominent example of this is something called OpenFlow. And a common architecture is that you have a central control plane server. So rather than like logging into each switch and setting things up there, you'd have all the switches contact a central server, and that would configure, act as the control plane, and they would just implement the decisions that central server made, really much easier way of configuring networks than kind of the old strategy, especially if you have a Google-sized network. We're going to talk a bit about the data plane. And to do that, there's another part of the software-defined networking movement that has been about, well, let's make the data plane programmable too. And kind of the leading approach on this is something called P4, which is a programming language specifically to write data planes. And the idea is that this is intended that switches can support P4 and you can upload a P4 program instead of relying on their fixed functionality. So if you want to customize how they, what sort of options you have for doing things with packets and frames, you can upload your own program to say how the switch should do that. And there's a standardized way, and the switch vendors just implement compilers that work best as possible for this programming language, which is the idea. We're going to use this in a future assignment, and also to talk about how switches actually work. Because even if this is not how all the switches we have out there work, it's a model that people have actually implemented and can give us sort of more insight than we'd have in the kind of the old world, where I can tell you what the switch does, but not what's happening internally, really, because Cisco never talks about it. So next time we'll talk about what P4 looks like and what it tells us about kind of a typical switch architecture. So that's where I'll finish up today.